my direct barrier to access, and indeed making it become that profit precedes people. I'm going to introduce our speakers. The first one, Alexandra, who is the director president of Gestos, an intellectual property working group in the Republic of Brazil, Lacaso, which is Latin America. Alessandro, if you can please take the stage. Each of our presenters, please remember you have a maximum of 11 minutes because we want to allow for question time.
Thank you. Well, thank you for the organizers of this conference to invite us to speak on this issue, especially at the time where we saw in the last month the failure of negotiations on the World Trade Organization. Maybe after that we can start thinking that another way to discuss commerce in this world is possible, and that people must be before trade. So, firstly, I'd like to apologize because I prepared my presentation in Spanish since I thought that we will have translation here from Spanish to English speaker, and just now they told me that it was impossible to have this kind of service. So my presentation will be Spanish, but I'm trying to translate it now to English to make possible all of you to understand what we are trying to say here. The first thing is trying to bring to you a context where we were discussing this issue of access to treatment in Brazil, and I was required to talk here about our case. We are taking the justice against Abbott Laboratories in the case of Caletra. But I think that's important to you understand that how the health system in Brazil is working regarding access to health and treatment in general. So we have here 1988, our constitution that guarantee right to health as a right that must be an obligation of states to provide to everybody. So in 1993, we started producing a local producing of AZT, and after that DDI. And in 1995, we had TRIPS. And in 1996, Brazilian instead to wait until 2005, as did India, for example, Brazilian government decided to sign the agreement, and in 1996, we have this property industrial law that impact today, we can affirm that make a huge problems to at least almost 2,000 companies and laboratories in Brazil that was dealing with production of some kind of medicines, especially to that could be possible to be producing HIV medicines. It was a huge impact in our system. At the same year, we have also the Lei Sarney, which is a lei that obligates obliged the states to provide free medicines to everybody who needs that, free medicines to HIV and AIDS. So at the same year, we have two laws, different laws, but at the same time, we have this good perspective of having free antiretroviral medicines for everybody who needs. Now, in 2006, Brazil is producing 8 antiretroviral drugs, but is providing almost 18 antiretroviral drugs for 175,000 people in Brazil who are needing these drugs. So we have all this number of people receiving treatment in Brazil now, nowadays. In 2001, we started with the discussion of treating the laboratories that if they don't lower the price, we will issue a compulsory license. We started this with Nelfinavir and Favirenz in 2001, but we just got a reduction of price. In 2003, the Brazilian government set up the baseline for how could work in Brazil a compulsory license. In 2004, the civil society and the health minister start a strong discussion about how could it be possible to have an alliance to implement, to release the compulsory license for some medicines. We have a huge crisis in that year. In the end of the year and beginning of 2005, we had a lack of medicines, and the government was saying that was an infrastructure problem. It was not specifically related to lack of money, but a lack of infrastructure to deliver the medicines. In 2005, the Brazilian government had set up a deadline to Gilead, Abbott, and Merck regarding asking for a compulsory, a voluntary license for these three medicines I'm referring here in my slide. But the laboratory just didn't listen to the government. They just care about our treatment to them. Here in these slides, you can see the difference, the impact of the starting giving second line drugs to people in Brazil. So we have in 2004 almost 600, more than 600,000 millions of reais for medicines, and in 2005, when we had some more expensive medicines, this resource was to almost 1 billion per year. So second line medicines brought a huge impact in our budget for giving free medicines to Brazilian people. Now we have three antiretroviral drugs that's costing to Brazilian government almost 8% of all budget we have to provide medicines to the people in Brazil. And we have now Caletra taking almost 30%, 27% of our budget for giving free medicines in Brazil. We had a lot of protests, and we went to the street many times asking governments to issue the compulsory license. We have also strong support for international communities. So we had a protest in London. We had in United States, in Washington, New York, and San Francisco. But it doesn't matter. We didn't achieve our goal. So our minister, Humberto Costa, at that time, became known as Tiger Without Teeth, because each time he was in an international level meeting, he was treating the laboratories to use the compulsory license, but we never did, unfortunately. Also, in June, the Brazilian government declared that compulsory license for Caletra was a matter of national interest. The Brazilian Council of Health also issued a resolution asking for compulsory license for Caletra, but, and this is the problem, despite all effort, we had everything organized, we had the opportunity, we had the right people in the right place, but in October 2005, the Brazilian government signed a horrible and a bad agreement with Abbott to buy Caletra until 2011. It was a shame for Brazil. It was a shame to the Brazilian government. And now we have to buy Caletra for 63 cents of dollar instead to be producing Caletra for 1 cent of dollar. Also, this agreement is about totally respect to the intellectual property of Ritonavir and Riponavir, and there is nothing about transfer of technology too. We have a strong reaction, of course, and we need to say that we have a group in Brazil named REBRIP, which is very well organized around this issue. REBRIP is coordinated by ABIA in Brazil, and many of our NGOs that are part of this group. We decided that it was time to do a lawsuit against the government, because the government was not respecting our right to health and was putting the Brazilian government, the Brazilian national program to provide free medicines in Brazil in great risk. We are in the great risk now, and to keep providing universal access to everybody who in need will be a big challenge in the next years for Brazil. So this is a kind of schizophrenic situation we are facing there, because at the same time we are known as to have one of the most well-organized national AIDS program. We have also decision makers in government that are not agreeing that health to, right to health is must be guaranteed. So it's a kind of contradiction. And for the next, for 2007, we'll have the increase of almost 50 or 60% of people in second line treatment would be impossible to keep. So lessons you learn was there is no respect to the international agreements or international resolutions. So now I just wrote down some of the main resolutions and agreements we had in the last time. And my question here is, do you need more resolutions? Do you need more agreement? Since the World Trade Organization agreed, United Nations agree, World Health Organization agree, health to rights is more important than commerce. But this is not happening at national level. Also, we learned that we can't do what they say, but we can't do what they do, because many countries, Canada, United States, Australia, Great Britain, many of them are using compulsory license for many years and when they need to use it. But to us, in the non-developed or developed countries, this is not possible to do. What is going on here? We are talking about rights or not, and rights, human rights, is for everybody or just for some part of the population in the world. I think this is a question we need to discuss here. Also, what we are seeing is that about resolutions and process and agreement, it doesn't matter too, because when these governments are not satisfied with these agreements, they just go into the bilateral agreements or free trade agreements, and they do what they want to do there. So, thank you. So also, all these processes are impeding us in the developing countries to strengthen our capacity of production and to strengthen our capacity to really guarantee human rights to everybody who needs and deserves human rights. So why just these countries can issue their compulsory license? This is my question for this discussion. Also, I think it's important to reflect that Saúde não é comércio, healthcare is not for commerce. And I think that we have three things that is important to make sure that we will win HIV and AIDS. One is to have the participation of civil society in all process. Second is to guarantee all possibilities to implement the human rights to everybody. And third, it's the political will of our government to do that. In Brazil, it's a case where we have the civil society participation, we have really beautiful laws to guarantee human rights, but we do not have the will of our politicians. And I think this is my message for this conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra. Now, next in our program is Anand Grover from India. Anand is a practicing lawyer in India, and he's also working with the project as a project director for the Lawyers Collective on HIV/AIDS in India.
Okay, this is in relation to what has happened in India. Now, until 1970, in India, there was a law which is very similar to laws in other countries, But in 1970, when Mrs. Gandhi was in power, she realized that the right to health is very important. And what she did was introduced a new law when she actually deleted the protection for what are known as product patents. Only process patents were protected. And because process patents are only protected, there's no product patent, you had new generic users, it enabled competition, and as a result, prices came down. Also as a result of this, drug manufacturers in India started coming down. Now, in that law, which existed even prior to the law that came in 2005, there were provisions of abuse of monopolies, compulsory licensing, and facilitating availability and access. Now, India signed, like a lot of other countries, the TRIPS regime. The TRIPS regime requires, if you're a signatory to the TRIPS regime, it's mandatory that you actually comply with it. If you don't comply, sanctions can be imposed. Unlike, for example, the United Nations Declaration for Human Rights. If you don't comply with those declarations or conventions, then all you will have is some abuse from the international community. But no sanctions can be imposed. Now, the TRIPS regime, the TRIPS agreement requires certain things to be done. One was patentability minimum standard was established. Within that minimum standards, countries would have flexibilities. The protection was to be for both products and processes. And the minimum period was to be for 20 years. Now, between 1995 and 2005, because different countries were to introduce TRIPS-compatible law by different dates. So India was supposed to comply with it by 2005. Least developing countries, for instance, by 2016. And they also gave the minimum conditions for compulsory licensing. Now, the TRIPS compliant law applies to drugs which come onto the world market after 1st January 1995, because that's the time when it was signed. In the interregnum between 1/1/95 and 1/1/2005, there were supposed to be certain provisions, and one of the provisions, which is important for my talk, is what is known as exclusive marketing rights. Now, if a company had a patent in another signatory country and marketing approval, it could come to India or for that matter to any other country and get exclusive marketing rights. I'll explain that again later. Now, in March 2005, India enacted a TRIPS compliant law. Actually, it was introduced in January 2005, but the act has retrospective effect from March 2005. It defined invention which is in compliance with TRIPS. It has to be for a new product and a process which involves what is known as an inventive step, and it has to be new and it has to be capable of industrial application. We need not go into the second one. What is important for us in our debate is what is Section 3D. As I explained to you earlier, under the TRIPS agreement, each country could have flexibility in defining what would be protected. India had to protect product patents, but it had the flexibility to do it in the way it thought fit. So what India did was, it said we are going to protect absolutely new products, but not new forms or new uses, except if they are significantly different in regard to efficacy. So as the Section 3D reads, the mere discovery of a new form of a new known substance, which does not result in the enhancement of known efficacy of that substance, or mere discovery, or new use of a known substance, is not an invention. But the explanation is also important. For the purposes of this clause, salts, esters, ethers, etc., 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 and other derivatives of known substances shall be considered to be the same substance. So if it's a salt or an ester or an isomer, then it's a new form, but it's the same substance, therefore it's not an invention. Now, this is very, very important, because in the United States, any new form, like a crystalline form or an isomer, is patentable. And the difference has to be on properties regarding to efficacy, and the difference has to be significant. Similarly, mere admixtures are not patentable. Now, under the patent law as it exists now, there was a big dispute, fight, civil society got involved, and we were able to gain concessions from the government. One of them was 3D. The other was to preserve what is called pre-grant opposition. Before a patent is granted to the patent, to the patent applicant, any person can actually make an application to resist that. And that is known as an opposition. So before the patent is granted, it's known as pre-grant opposition. after the patent is granted is known as post-grant opposition. Then there are other ways of checking availability and affordability. They are voluntary licensing, revocation, compulsory licensing, which Alessandra talked about, non-commercial public use, which Sangeeta is going to talk about. And in India, we have another system altogether, which is to control prices under what is known as the Drug Price Control Order, which applies to drugs which have a turnover of about $2 million, but it doesn't really apply to government, to imported drugs. Now the government is thinking of linking price control with granting of patents. That's an open question. We don't know how they're going to do it. Now, oppositions is what I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes. They are pre-grant under Section 25(1), and it can be opposed by any person. And 25(2), which is post-grant. The grounds are identical, and I'll now go to some examples. Now, one of the cases which have gone to court is the case of a drug which is known as Gleevec, which is an anti-cancer drug. It treats chronic myeloid leukemia. In December 2003, Novartis AG, was granted exclusive marketing rights because it had got a patent in Australia and marketing approval in Australia. So they came with that and told the Indian authorities, we've got that. Under the TRIPS agreement, you have to give us that. Under your law, you have to give us the exclusive marketing right. They got that. And they filed cases against generic manufacturers. There were 7 generic manufacturers manufacturing the same drug. What was the price difference? Novartis price in India per month per patient was $2,700 for that drug. And generic companies were giving that drug at $200 per month. And our clients, which was the Cancer Patient AIDS Association, they were actually subsidizing it and giving it to the patient for $25. So they were subsidizing to the extent of $175. So when the Patent Act came into force in March 2005, they actually made the application for patents. That's what you have to require to do. And we filed an opposition. In the application, they said that it's a particular compound called imatinib mesylate. It's a salt form. And they contended that a particular crystalline form, beta crystalline form, was totally inventive. It was a new product. It was significantly different in terms of efficacy. And therefore, they should be granted a patent. They said it had already been granted in 35 countries, and therefore Indian authorities should also grant it. Now, the Cancer Patient Association, the Cancer Patient AIDS Association, they filed an opposition. They said that it's not a new drug. It's a salt form of a known drug. It's an obvious drug. It's just a small improvement of a known substance, and there is no real difference in the properties. And whether other countries grant patents or not is not relevant for Indian patent law, because the Indian patent law has specific provisions which don't allow those sort of things to be patented. Now, in January 2006, the Patent Office, this is the first case which was actually decided by the patent controller after the new act came into force, they actually rejected the patent. Now, Novartis never expected that this would happen. And for a long time, they lay low. And now, after about 8 months, they have now filed, just before I came from India, they filed a judicial review application, 2 applications. One is to challenge the order of the patent controller. And secondly, they've challenged the validity, the constitutional validity of Section 3D, which I talked about earlier. That new forms and new uses are not patentable. Now, I don't know how they will succeed in that. That matter is coming up in the Madras High Court on 23rd of March. Now, apart from Gleevec, which has been decided partly, because it has to go through the whole process, and Novartis is going to take it right up to the Supreme Court, so it's going to be a tough battle. And some of the groups for access to treatment are actually meeting, because on 23rd of this month, there's going to be some protest. The other oppositions that have been filed are of Combivir, Tenofovir, Abacavir, Atazanavir, Valganciclovir, and Abrenavir. Most of these have been filed by the Network of Positive People, but we are also filing oppositions on behalf of other health groups. And those of you who are interested, there is a group on internet which is for information about these issues, so you can know. What are the objections? Same thing. The invention is not new, it's obvious. It's just a new use. It's not patentable under the Indian law under Section 3D. If it's a combination, it's just a new form. Again, it is not a patentable thing. And if it's a mixture, it's a mere admixture and doesn't actually enhance efficacy at all. And some of the cases, they have not disclosed that patent applications were pending in other countries, which are either rejected or they have withdrawn. So this is the position. Now, just two other things that I want to talk about. As it is now, why is this important? Because India supplies 50% of the demand in the developing countries. So what happens in India in regard to these first line and second line, and of course third line drugs, will impact not only India, but the whole of the developing world. Secondly, unfortunately and shamelessly, India, which is the largest supplier of antiretroviral drugs at the cheapest prices, Indian positive people estimated to be 5.2 million, out of which about 500,000 require ARVs. You won't believe, only 20,000 are getting it free. Only 20,000. So Indian groups, we have to do a lot of work, and this is a start of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Sangeeta Shashikant from Malaysia. Sangeeta is a researcher of and is working with the Third World Network in Malaysia.
Good morning. What I intend to do in the time allocated to me is to talk about the Malaysian experience and how Malaysia has made use of the TRIPS flexibilities to increase access to more affordable ARVs, and how the use of TRIPS flexibilities are now being undermined by the current negotiations that are taking place between Malaysia and the United States. So in 2003, Malaysia was the first Asian country, following the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health, to issue a government use order to import generic versions of patented ARVs from India. And for those who are not familiar with what government use is, it's basically a TRIPS flexibility which allows a license which is issued by the government to make use of the patented product for its use, for public non-commercial use, without the need for prior negotiations or consent of the patent holder. Now, this was an initiative that was begun by the Ministry of Health because they had tried to negotiate with the patent holder to reduce the prices of ARVs, but they were not very successful because the reductions that they received were still not sufficient, and it was not enough for the budget they had allocated to procure ARVs. So in November 2002, the Ministry of Health submitted a paper to the Cabinet to import ARVs from India, and Cabinet approved it using Section 84 of the Malaysian Patent Act, which allows for government use. Now, if you see the beginning section of the slide, those were the drugs that were imported under the government use authorization, and there were two patent holders that were involved. There was BMS and GSK. And below that is the conditions of the government use order, and the important condition was that the imported drugs were for the supply of the government hospitals, and the government use was for 2 years. Now, as a result of the government use authorization, the average cost of treatment per person per year dropped from $315 to $58. And this is an 81% reduction in cost. And this increased the number of patients that could be treated from 1,500 to 4,000 people. If you look at the first box, you'll see that it dropped from 2001, the patented price was $261, and in 2004, the generic price was $45. This was under the government use. And the second one is $362, which has dropped to $115. What is interesting is that as a result of the government use authorization as well, the patent holders themselves also dropped the prices of their own medicines. Didenosine, they dropped about 50%. From 2001, it was about $63. In 2004, it came down to $32. That is about a 59% drop in price. The other product as well, it had an 82% drop. GSK also dropped its prices. Combivir, it dropped by 80%, AZT 53%, 3TC 67%. Now, for the government, one of the requirements was that they had to pay remuneration to the patent holder, and this was a requirement of the TRIPS agreement, and they had proposed a 4% of the value of stocks actually delivered, and according to the Ministry of Health, the patent holder has shown no interest, and this is information as of February 2006, they have shown no interest in collecting the remuneration, and some of the reasons they gave us was because they feel that the patent holder might feel that it would set a precedent for future government use authorizations in the country. It could be very bad publicity for the patent holder if they accepted it. It is a sign of acceptance of their rights to issue a government use authorization. And this was the information that we got from the Ministry of Health. The government use authorization ended in November 2005, and the Ministry of Health considered two options. The first was to negotiate prices of patented products to an acceptable level. The second was they could apply also for a renewal of the authorization, but it seems that they have opted to negotiate the prices because they feel that they had granted a government use authorization, and that was an advantage, and they could use that to negotiate prices of patent products, because as you saw, as a result of the government use authorization, the prices of the patented products as well dropped drastically. Now, what are some of the challenges? One of the major challenges was the opposition from the patent holders. After the cabinet decision to issue authorization, GSK offered to drop the price of Combivir by 57%. There were complaints against the Malaysian government that were lodged, and meetings were held between legal representatives. They questioned whether what Malaysia was doing was actually legal under the TRIPS agreement, and there were suggestions that this would actually affect the investment decisions in Malaysia. Now, this kind of raised a lot of concerns with other ministries, for example, the Ministry of Domestic and Trade, and they then put pressure on the Ministry of Health to say, look, do not go ahead with issuing the government use authorization. But the Ministry of Health stood firm, the Cabinet reaffirmed the decision, and a lot of the strength when Malaysia issued the government use authorization came from the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health. We also understand that a lawsuit has been filed in Malaysia by one of the patent holders, although this has not been activated. As you can see, Malaysia is just one of the countries that has actually made use of the government use, has made use of the TRIPS flexibilities. There are also other countries such as Indonesia, Zimbabwe that have also made use of the TRIPS flexibilities. For example, in Indonesia, a presidential decree was also issued on 5th October 2004, and the decree said that they issued it because in light of the urgent need of the community in the effort to control HIV/AIDS epidemic. And the decree empowers the Minister of Health in Indonesia to appoint a pharmaceutical factory as the patent exploiter on behalf of the government. And this is, and Indonesia offered 0.5% as payment of royalty because they said they were having an economic crisis and they could not afford to pay more. Now we see that countries are just beginning to understand what TRIPS flexibility is all about. It is very legalistic, it is very technical. Civil society has played a huge role in increasing awareness about the need to use flexibilities. And we hear a lot of countries wanting to make use of the flexibilities. Now, while this is happening, what we see is TRIPS Plus obligations emerging in bilateral free trade agreements that undermine the use of these flexibilities. In particular, you see that in the US free trade agreements. Now, these are generally the TRIPS Plus provisions that you'll find in the FTAs. One might differ slightly from the other. But you will see that some of these provisions, for example, data exclusivity, this provision was rejected outrightly when TRIPS was being negotiated. But now it's coming back again in the bilateral free trade agreements. This is coming back through the back door. It's not just on IP, it's also on a lot of other issues of trade. Now, just to quickly run through, the first one you find is data exclusivity. Data exclusivity, this prevents the drug regulatory authority from using the data that is generated by the originator company to authorize the registration of generic products. The second is there are restrictions on the grounds on which compulsory license can be granted. You can grant it just on grounds of, say, national emergency. You can grant it for in situations of extreme urgency or for public non-commercial use, but for no other grounds. And civil society, the civil society and also the governments fought very hard for in Doha Declaration to make sure that the grounds were unlimited. The grounds on which compulsory licenses can be issued were unlimited. The third provision you see is turning the drug regulatory authority into patent police. The drug regulatory authority has the job of registering drugs. They do not have to monitor whether a product is patented or not. But now under the bilaterals, this is coming about where the drug regulatory authorities are being asked to become patent police. Then you have the extension of patent term. If there is delay in the granting of a patent, then the patent term is extended by that time period. Restriction or prohibition on parallel importation and require the grant of patent on new use of known pharmaceutical products. As you heard Anand speaking about how India has excluded new use of known pharmaceutical products, now this is being required in bilateral free trade agreements. Now, what is the impact of these provisions? If you take the case of Malaysia, in 2003, we issued a government use authorization, and you have seen the information that I've shown you, the data. That information is from the Ministry of Health, and the prices of ARVs have dropped. The number of patients that can be treated have increased. But we are also negotiating now. We are in the third round of negotiations with the United States, which means that we will most likely have to take on these obligations. And if we do take on these obligations, then the impact is that we could issue a government use authorization, but perhaps with data exclusivity, we cannot make use of the product in the country. So you have got government use authorization, but you cannot register the drug in the country. So what is the use of this flexibility? If you want to issue a compulsory license, then you can only do it on certain limited grounds. So these are the problems that are not only being faced by Malaysia, but will also be faced by a lot of other countries that are currently negotiating, that have negotiated bilateral free trade agreements. Now, I'd like to just end with a slide showing where we were and where we are now. Before the TRIPS agreement, there weren't minimum standards on intellectual property right. Right, so you had like this blank sheet of slide. Then what we have at that time was an institution called WIPO, which is World Intellectual Property Organization. Now, the treaty related to patent was the Paris Convention, and this provided for very minimal obligations. And you only had to take on these obligations if you were a party to this treaty. Then came about the TRIPS Agreement. Now, TRIPS agreement was the first multilateral agreement that prescribed minimum standards on intellectual property rights. And you cannot discriminate between sectors. So you cannot say, medicines, we do not want to grant patents. You had to grant patents. And this is applicable to all WTO countries. Developing countries, when this was being negotiated at the WTO as part of the single undertaking, developing countries said, no, we are not going to negotiate this. But they traded off because they felt that they would get something else in agriculture, in other areas of trade. So they said, okay, we'll take on this TRIPS obligations. But then they fought very hard for flexibilities. Following TRIPS, we have more standard setting exercises taking place in the World Intellectual Property Organization. And these standard setting exercises are also in relation to patents. I do not want to go too much into what is happening in WIPO, but one of the very controversial agreements is something called the Substantive Patent Law Treaty, and this will take standards way beyond TRIPS agreement and will remove a lot of the flexibilities that you have in the TRIPS agreement. A lot of the standards that are being set also reflect the demands and of the developed countries. But these treaties are voluntary. Or they were voluntary. That means if you take on this, if you ratify the treaty, then only then you have to take on those obligations. Now we have the free trade agreements. Now, this requires countries to ratify a lot of the WIPO treaties. Many of the developing countries had not ratified the WIPO treaties, but one of the obligations in the free trade agreement is that you have to ratify the WIPO treaties. For example, Malaysia, there was immense pressure on us to ratify something called the Patent Cooperation Treaty. And statistics show that as soon as you ratify the Patent Cooperation Treaty, the number of patents in your country increases. So this is where we are currently. And I think that if we are seriously concerned about access to medicines, we have to think of ways on how to scale back what is happening at the international level, at the regional level as well, and to scale back on intellectual property rights, especially patents. And perhaps we have to think about carving out medicines from what is happening, from the trend setting that is taking place on intellectual property rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Sanjitan. Our last speaker is Jonathan Berger, who is a senior researcher and head of policy and research at the AIDS Law Project in South Africa.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Today I'm going to be speaking about two successful civil society campaigns in South Africa that managed to increase access to essential medicines for treating either HIV infection or AIDS-related illnesses. Both of the campaigns are relatively old. They happened quite some time back. The lessons I think that they teach us are still very relevant. The reason there have been no recent campaigns is not because there's no need for that, but as many of you will know, living in a country like South Africa, with the president who still believes there is no link between HIV and AIDS, with the health minister who promotes the use of untested remedies instead of proven treatments, we have many, many other issues that are occupying our time and many other legal battles. So while you may not be hearing any recent stuff coming out of South Africa on access to medicines, please watch this space. As soon as we have dealt with some of the other matters, we're certainly going to be getting back to companies. Companies like Abbott, companies like Merck, companies like Gilead. The access battle in South Africa, in that respect, has not yet been won. The second point, just before I start, there is a session this afternoon at 4:15 dealing with access to dealing with the forgotten epidemic, HIV/AIDS in prisons. It's a shameless plug for a presentation I'm making there on a case that we are currently fighting on access to treatment for prisoners in South Africa. One of the 15 clients on whose behalf we brought the case died last week. He was only put onto treatment July of this year, some 20 months after his CD4 count was identified at 87. Died a month ago. Many others are going to die if the South African government doesn't get its act into gear quickly. Today's presentation really focuses on three issues. Firstly, I want to sketch a little bit about the South African context, because I think before one can understand why certain actions were taken or not taken, it is important to look at, well, what are the particular access concerns that we have? What is the broader political context? Why are some actors acting? Why are others not acting? And then also, what is the constitutional framework within which we operate? Then the two case studies that I will focus on very briefly. The first is Hazel Tau and others versus GlaxoSmithKline and Boehringer Ingelheim, using competition law to increase access to three antiretrovirals in particular. And then the second case, once again using competition law, to challenge the excessively priced essential antifungal drug amphotericin B, an off-patent drug. So while much attention is focused on patents, I don't think we must ever lose sight of the fact that the issue is not necessarily patent protection. The issue is no competition in medicines. Patents have a significant role to play in that. But in many cases, there are no patents, but there is no competition, and prices remain as high as they ever were. And then to conclude, a few thoughts on where we need to go. The access concerns in South Africa are really twofold. Firstly, the issue of excessive pricing, and that is something that has improved over the years. It certainly hasn't been resolved. Prices are still too high. And there is much room for those prices to come down. A second point, and this links to a point that was made this morning in the presentation on Rwanda, and that is the issue of sustainability of supply. We are very concerned that even where prices may be the lowest that are available, may not be the lowest that they can ever go to, but maybe the lowest that they are currently available, having a single supplier in respect of any antiretroviral is not a way to ensure a sustainable program. One needs sustainability of supply. We have seen in certain circumstances in South Africa stockouts of drugs, countries like Botswana that are entirely reliant on patented drugs have run out of drugs, and we have correspondence in our possession where a letter sent by GlaxoSmithKline to the government of Botswana saying, we are unable to provide you with, I think it was AZT at the time, please contact Aspen Pharmacare in South Africa and they will provide you with the drug. This is notwithstanding the fact that as a result of the Hazeltal case, Botswana has a legal right to import drugs from a company like Aspen in South Africa without having to get a letter authorizing them to do so from GlaxoSmithKline. In terms of the political context, what is very important to understand is that there was and has been and continues to be very little movement on ensuring that there, A, is a proper regulatory framework to ensure that drugs are affordable, and B, the use of the limited provisions that we have in our law. Sangeeta spoke about the Malaysian example of government use, the government use provision. We have a similar provision in our law. It has been there for many, many years. It is TRIPS compliant. It is consistent with our constitution, and yet government refuses to make use of that provision time and time again. They don't even threaten the use of that provision. They simply act as if their hands have been cut off and they are unable to act. In that context, the leadership has been shown by civil society, and civil society has been forced to look for creative ways to make use of a imperfect but still a partially useful legal framework. That legal framework that I'm talking about falls within our broader constitutional framework, one in which socioeconomic rights are expressly protected. The right of access to healthcare services, a constitutionally guaranteed right in the South African Constitution, which places positive obligations on the state to ensure that people are able to get access to healthcare services. And in numerous cases, our courts have held that access to healthcare services includes access to essential medicines. So even in cases where the government is not obliged to provide the medicines free of charge to everyone, certainly to those who, in the absence of free drugs, would not be able to afford it. They do have an obligation, but for those who have money, the obligation on government is to ensure that the drugs are affordably priced. So where provisions exist that can be used to reduce medicine prices, there is a constitutional obligation to make use of those provisions. We have not seen that happening. The final point that I think is important under our constitutional framework is that all legislation has to be interpreted in line with the socioeconomic rights provisions and all provisions of our Bill of Rights. So it's not good enough to say, well, this is an act that deals with competition law, this deals with unfair trade, this deals with intellectual property, it has nothing to do with human rights. Under the South African Constitution and certainly under international human rights law, there is an obligation to interpret the provisions on patents, the provisions on competition law, in compliance with fundamental rights of access to health care, of rights to life, and things like that. The two case studies, in very briefly in summary, the first one focused on three essential antiretrovirals. At the time, all three of them were patented, AZT, 3TC, and Nevirapine. The three of them are three of the seven essential antiretrovirals that are provided in the South African public sector antiretroviral treatment program. At the time the case was launched, the first case was launched, there was no generic competition for any of these drugs. There is some now, and I'll describe that a bit later, and AZT has subsequently come off patent. And the focus of that case was on excessively priced private sector prices. We focused on the private sector because the public sector at that point was not providing treatment at all to anyone. So there were theoretical prices, but certainly not prices that we could challenge. The second case deals with the antifungal drug amphotericin B, an off-patent drug, but there were no generic equivalents on the market. And one has to ask the question, Where are the generic companies when it comes to many of the drugs that are not on patent? Drugs like ganciclovir is not patent protected in South Africa. Drugs like amphotericin B, and yet we are not seeing generic versions of those drugs on the market. They need to come to the party as well. The case dealt both with the public and the private sector prices of amphotericin B. I see my time is starting to run out, so I will rapidly go through the two cases. The first case was based on a provision of our competition law, section 8A, which talks about engaging in excessive pricing to the detriment of consumers. So one has to prove excessive pricing, one has to prove detriment, and those two were not too difficult to prove in our case. We were quite blunt in the case. We said the prices that they were charging were directly responsible for the premature, predictable, and avoidable deaths of people living with HIV and AIDS. Too much at this conference is about tiptoeing around the issues. We don't really speak clearly about what the issues were. In this case, we were upfront. We said, your prices are killing people. You need to lower those prices. We're going to force you to lower your prices. We took a very conservative approach to this case, and we really try to bend over backwards and to say, well, even if you consider everything that you say you have to consider, your manufacturing costs, your research and development costs, your licensing costs, and we'll be decent guys, we'll even give you reasonable profits. We don't believe you're the International Red Cross. You do need to be in business. But even when you take all of that into consideration, you cannot justify the prices that you are charging. That was the case that we made and the case that we hoped that they would come to court or to answer. The matter was settled in December 2003 before it was going to be referred to our competition tribunal for adjudication. Many of the complex legal issues remain unresolved, but for us it was a difficult decision to take. On the one hand, we wanted to push forward and get some good case law and make sure that we had a solid precedent that we could use again. But on the other hand, lives were in the balance and we really needed to get affordable medicines out there. One of the benefits of agreeing to a settlement was that in November 2003, government had already published the antiretroviral treatment program, and it was essential that generic medicines were part of that program. The complaint was an excessive pricing complaint. It resulted in a licensing solution. And on the slide, you can see the terms and conditions that we ensured are applied to all of the licenses that are granted. In respect of GlaxoSmithKline, there was an agreement that they would grant at minimum four licenses, and Boehringer Ingelheim three licenses for each of the drugs. And this slide, you can see these are private sector prices. They are still unreasonably high, but you can see the price differentials are quite great from the prices of the medicines at the time the complaint was lodged, as opposed to the cheapest generic available in the private sector today, ranging from between 57.6% to as much as 88% reduction on lamivudine. Finally, on the amphotericin B case, this was a case that worked hot on the heels of the Hazel Tower case, and we really didn't even need to file papers with our competition authorities. A series of letters that went back and forth between us and the lawyers of Bristol Myers Squibb. They thought they could teach us a few lessons in competition law. We told them if they wanted to engage in that kind of debate, then we'll deal with them in court. But for now, we wanted them to justify their pricing policy. They were not able to justify their pricing policy. Instead, what they did was they reduced their prices in the private sector by 85% and the public sector by 80%. At the time, the public sector price for this drug, a crucial drug for treating cryptococcal meningitis in the first 2 weeks, was $20 per patient per day. At the end of the matter, it came down from $20 to $3 a day. Then, to conclude, I think it's important that the lesson that one can learn is that one doesn't have to sit back and wait for governments to take the lead. Most of our governments are scoundrels. They are not going to act. They are quite happy to stand back and to blame the evil George Bush, to blame the evil World Trade Organization, and in many respects they are correct when they say that. but they don't take responsibility themselves. They really do need to act. They need to implement what international law allows them to do, and they need to move forward before they have the lives of their own people on their own hands. And to end with, I'll leave this final slide for you, which needs no explanation. Thank you.
Thank you to Jonathan. We're now going to hand over to our panelists who have each received a set of questions written on cards to each take 3 minutes to respond to all their questions.
Yes, I don't know. Should we start with Sangeeta? Do you feel comfortable to start with your question? You had the time to read them already.
The first question I have is, how do data exclusivity restrictions in bilateral free trade agreements affect countries' ability to use WHO's pre-qualification program to expedite drug approval? If I'm not mistaken, data exclusivity provisions do not affect WHO pre-qualification. What it does is, you see, before a drug can be used in a country, it has to be registered in the country. They have to obtain marketing approval. So what data exclusivity provision actually does is that the generic version usually relies on the test data, the clinical data that is created, generated by the originator company to get marketing approval for its product. So for the generic to get marketing approval, it just has to show that it is equivalent to the originator drug. It does not usually generate its own test data. So it gets registered on the basis of the first drug being registered. And so if you have data exclusivity provisions, that means to say the patent holder has exclusive right over its data for, say, 5 to 10 years, and I think that's what countries are now implementing, between 5 years to 11 years. If that is the case, then generic versions cannot enter into the market during that period. And this also applies not just to patented products. This also applies to non-patented product. So even if the product is not patented, the first product, but the patent holder, but the producer has got rights over the test data, no generic can enter into the market. And so this is a problem when you talk about data exclusivity provisions. Now the second question that I have is on TRIPS flexibilities. Professor Brooke Baker from US has asked the question, TRIPS flexibilities are not good enough, don't we need to campaign to relax intellectual property rights to prevent IPRs in bilateral and regional trade agreements, and instead to treat medicines as the public goods that they are? Well, definitely TRIPS flexibilities are not good enough, because right now we have the flexibilities, but there is so much pressure not to make use of the flexibilities. You can see in the case that I presented, the Malaysian case, it was just because the Ministry of Health was determined that a government use authorization would be issued. During the cabinet meeting, the Prime Minister himself said, we are going to go ahead and do this because there is this Doha Declaration and it's our right to do it. Because of that, we had the government use authorization. But a lot of countries, there's so much pressure not to make use of the TRIPS flexibilities. In fact, as soon as it is heard that you want to make use of flexibilities, there's a lot of pressure from the industry, from the other ministries in the country, for you not to avail yourself of those flexibilities. You take the case of Indonesia. What I understand in Indonesia is when they wanted to issue the government use order, what I've been told is all those people who are aware of the fact that the Indonesian government was going to do this, they were told that, look, you have to keep this a secret. It's going to come under the Official Secrets Act or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was the case in Indonesia, because they knew otherwise there would be a lot of pressure on them not to do so. So there are flexibilities, but we just cannot seem to use them when we really need to do so. And then there is pressure for us to adopt TRIPS Plus standards and then to limit the flexibilities that we have. Now, in relation to the argument that is usually put forward by patent holders is that We need more higher standards of patents. We need data exclusivity provisions because we need to recoup investments. You know, there's a lot of money which has gone into R&D, etc. But if you look at the data, we see more and more patents being granted. But the innovation, the new chemical entities that are actually being researched and that are being developed are very, very few. So it does not really support the idea that if you have got patents, if you have DE, then you're going to have a lot more new medicines, new innovations. And there's a recent report which has been issued by the WHO Commission on Intellectual Property Rights, Innovation and Health. And the report, the commission identifies that patents in low-income countries does nothing for innovation. And they have one of the recommendations is that companies should not apply for patents in low-income countries. So definitely, to answer the question, TRIPS flexibilities is not enough. We have to think about actually taking TRIPS out of WTO, because it's not just in relation to medicines. We are talking also in terms for development, because developing countries are users of intellectual property rights, whereas developed countries are exporters of intellectual property rights. So what happens is that even when you talk about access to technology, that is being hampered. If you take the case of India, one of the major reasons they were also able to develop their pharmaceutical industry was because they had no product patent in the country between 1970 and 2005.
Please finalize.
Yeah, so I would think we do need to look at ways on carving out, if not for other areas, but at least for medicines, carving out from the IP system, because this is an essential item and we cannot trade away this essential item. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to ask the panelists to please really summarize your questions, because there's millions of questions and it's really critical that we try and get through quite a few of them. So please.
Anand Grover?
Yeah, there are three questions. The first one, what are the generic companies in India doing for people living with HIV? They supply ARVs outside India, and in their backyard, 20,000 patients out of 5 million. It's shameful. It's not a question. I agree with that thing. I think the point has to be made, and we have to do a lot in India about it. So that's, in fact, we started the campaign yesterday here. The second question by Robin Stern from the U.S. Universities Allied for Essential Medicines. What position has the generic industry in India taken with regard to the protection of intellectual property rights? Have they supported civil society's push for greater access? Has that changed over time? Very important and interesting question. The Indian industry is like any other industry. They are interested in making profits. Please have no doubts about that. Now, what has happened over from 1995 to 2005 is that there has been a split within the Indian originally generic industry. One is, and it's represented by, in fact, the new organizations of the Indian industry that have come in. In India, there is the US and European multinationals, and that's called the Organization of Pharmaceutical Producers of India, which represent the US MNCs and some of the European MNCs. Then there are two Indian associations, the Indian Drug Manufacturers Association, which is just the generic industry, and the Indian Pharmaceutical Alliance, which is the research and development Indian industry. It used to be generic, but now actually it is actually getting into alliances with US and European MNCs. It's acquiring companies in Germany, some in the US, and Ranbaxy, for instance, is part of that. And they are exporting Ranbaxy. Their production, 50% of the production is for the US market. They are not interested only in the Indian people living with HIV. They are like the US MNCs. They also want to make a lot of profit. So we have no doubts about it. So it's not about Indian or non-Indian. It's about generics. Okay? Then there's a question by D. Kavanaugh from the United States. To understand that after the Doha Accord, the U.S. Trade Representative forced India not to cease exports of AIDS drugs to Nigeria or lose all its U.S. foreign aid. Can Messrs. Clinton and Messrs. Gates mold opinion to stop this? I think it's a very important question. You hit the nail on the head. Mr. Clinton and Mr. Gates should tell the U.S. administration to stop using 301 and 301 special in any cases altogether. And the hypocrisy is evident, because it's all right to talk about, and it's very good to talk about harm reduction, but they have to start talking about politics which affects U.S. oil industry and the U.S. multinational pharma industry.
Okay, a few questions now to Jonathan.
Okay, thanks. I have quite a few. I'm going to try and get through them quickly. A question from Murray Lowe from South Africa, talking about the definition of national emergency under TRIPS in respect of compulsory licensing, and isn't AIDS a national emergency? Certainly under the Doha Declaration, it's clear that the HIV/AIDS pandemic is considered a national emergency, but over and above that, countries are free to determine for themselves what is an emergency. In any event, the issue of national emergency is only relevant to the process by which compulsory licenses are granted. It certainly does not affect the right to grant such licenses. The only thing that if there is an emergency, you don't need to enter into any kind of prior negotiations. You can merely step in and issue the licenses. But the right to grant licenses is not dependent on an emergency whatsoever. The second question is from Steve Hubbard from Canada, talking about the disconnect between the progressive post-apartheid constitution that we have and a terrible record of inaction on the part of government, and what are the factors leading to this lack of accountability. It's an incredibly difficult question to answer in a couple of moments. I'll just throw out a few issues. I think we have no decent opposition in Parliament, or in the only opposition is opposition that comes from civil society itself. We have an electoral system of strict proportional representation, which means that parliamentarians are accountable to the party bosses and not to the people who voted, who got them into power in the first place. So we have a parliament that in many respects acts as a rubber stamping agency. And if one wants evidence of how loyalty is prized over anything else, one merely has to look at the very long tenure of our Minister of Health to see that if you're loyal, if you do what the boss wants you to do, you will keep your job no matter how much you wreck the economy, no matter how much you destroy the lives of people living with HIV. Let's left two more questions. I'll be brief. Professor Nasiri from the USA, if amphotericin B is not available in South Africa, what alternative agent is used? Where it wasn't available in the public sector, as far as I understand, treatment was only being provided by the use of fluconazole. At the moment, now that it is available, and not sure how widely it is available, it should be available in every public health facility. The first 2 weeks of treatment will be with amphotericin B, followed by fluconazole maintenance. The fluconazole itself goes back to a long campaign led by the Treatment Action Campaign to bring the price of that drug down. So all of these things kind of tying in together quite nicely. Dudu from South Africa says, is it not good that the Minister of Health has made available various options for people living with HIV? What more still needs to be done? I think it is important to recognize that there has been progress and development in South Africa, but that it really has come at the end of a barrel of a gun. Government has reacted. It has really not led from the front. The issue of making available various options, I think, for me, raises very uncomfortable concerns about what I call the false rhetoric of choice, where unproven remedies are presented as equivalents to registered treatments. And I think that perhaps is the biggest danger, is where we see in South Africa at the moment, where under the guise of human rights language, we talk about choice, but we don't actually give people the correct information. We don't enforce our laws correctly to ensure that people are able to make informed choices so that they know when they take a particular medicine that it has been approved for their use, and that it is not mere wishful thinking that a particular traditional remedy may have a desired effect. And then my final question is from Dr. Ambe from Cameroon. There are a few questions here, but the one I'm going to focus on is talking about the denialism in HIV, the questioning the link between HIV and AIDS. How has this progressed over time, or how has it affected access to treatment in South Africa? Certainly, it has affected the pace of the rollout. South Africa, our the gap between those who have treatment and those who need treatment is rising in South Africa. It currently sits probably at more than 500,000 people. And for as long as we do not resolve and we do not clear up the mess that has been caused over the years by the denialism, people are going to remain confused. Healthcare workers are not going to know what to do, and political leaders at lower levels are not going to know what is going to satisfy the party bosses. Should they be pressing ahead very strongly to implement this treatment program, or is that going to cost them their jobs at the end of the day? Until we have clear leadership from the top saying that HIV causes AIDS, that antiretrovirals save lives, until we have that, this program is not going to be implemented in a way which is going to turn this epidemic around.
Okay, thank you very much. I will. We still have a lot of questions. It will not be possible to answer all of them. I have a couple of requests here. One is to read a very short statement that has been made by a bunch of a coalition of NGOs, saying access to treatment, people before trade. I think they are passing on here to sign this. We, the participants, attended the 16th International AIDS Conference, demand that our governments and trade negotiators protect the public from the potential negative consequences of bilateral and regional trade agreements on public health. These agreements enforce even stronger standards of intellectual property protection than imposed by the WTO TRIPS agreement. Current WTO intellectual property rules are already making it difficult for countries to access affordable medicines. WTO countries must commit to a moratorium on any new bilateral and regional trade agreements that include provisions involving intellectual property rights and medicines. All WTO members must agree they will not enforce any provision in a manner contrary to the 2001 Doha Declaration on TRIPS and public health in such agreements. And so this is, I think, circulating, and I know that already Steve, some important people already have signed it, I've heard, and also that there is a gathering just around the corner here at this floor at 1 o'clock for people who want to march on this issue. There are a lot of questions on research and development versus compulsory license. I just would like, maybe we won't have time to answer this, just maybe would like to say that there is a lot of material that has been written on these issues showing that actually 90% of the world pharmaceutical market is in the rich countries, that R&D has been always designed to attend the rich countries mainly, and that if you have these medicines in the developing countries, it's because actually there is a need first in the rich countries. But I don't think panelists will have time to answer these questions, because we are already getting close to the end of our session, and maybe I would just like to ask each of them to close the discussion with a couple of minutes, maybe answering the last questions that they have. And
just before the panelists, there is just one more request from a Dr. Ruth Koenig working in South Africa, who says she's unable to provide second-line treatments to her patients and is therefore at a loss, and recommends that this meeting should afterwards proceed to the pharmaceutical company exhibition stands, where we should go demand that they should drop the prices and stop putting pressure on governments who want to do the right thing. So that's a request, and those who want to proceed with that could perhaps gather it outside the hall when we are done.
So the panelists, please. Alessandra.
Thank you, Michelle. The question that was addressed to me was about which hope we have facing this situation, what we can do at the country level. And I think that it was mentioned here that despite all facts, all legal barriers we are facing, now we have also to prepare more, many spaces to deal with the discussion. One of them was mentioned was to prepare the legal systems in national country to deal with this implication of patent laws and to know how to address the question. In Brazil, we are really concerned about this specific population, because what we are seeing is that people who are deciding about this law, they are not well prepared. They just don't know what we are talking about. So this is one point. Second point, and to me it's really complex, is how can you fight back all communication this company and this laboratory are promoting around the world about what means generic drugs. So there is a prejudice even among people who are taking medicines, who are needing medicines, about generic drugs, because the market so hard saying that generic drugs means bad drugs. So it's something you need to fight back. And now Abbott is talking really badly about the generic drugs we are producing in Brazil. And this is something we need to strategize. How can you return? And the other question is that we need to prepare better our activists and our people in the ground, because if the 80s HIV and AIDS was a question of public health, in the 90s it was a matter of human rights, now this is basically also a question of commerce. But this is hard to people who are on the ground to understand all this complexity and all discussions we are facing here. So I think each country needs to find out their possibilities. But I think that we all together need to work in order to make sure that the information will be available in our capacity and skills will be also available to everybody who is in this field. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll quickly answer the questions that one was actually addressed to Sangeeta, but it was about India. So, do generic companies perform bioequivalence studies for their products? Yes. I'm not going to take time on that. But the second question is very interesting. Gilead Sciences recently announced both filing of patent applications for tenofovir in India as well as signing voluntary licenses with Indian generic companies. Could you address this? How could it impact the access to drugs? Well, you know, the funny thing is Gilead doesn't have a patent in India. They are actually making, actually entering into voluntary licenses with Indian companies. It's not under the patent law as such, because some of the Indian companies are afraid that if the patent is ultimately granted, then they'll be knocked out of business. And therefore, they're entering into voluntary licenses. Now, it means that the Indian generic companies are being neutralized. So it is going to impact on prices in the long term. And it's anybody's guess how long Indian generic companies will remain completely free of being taken over or, you know, coalescing with the multinationals. So these type of tactics are being used by multinationals to ultimately not only enter into agreements, but actually merge with them or even take them over.
I've been asked to address this issue of voluntary license versus compulsory license. You look at voluntary license, what is it? Well, where the patent holder voluntarily grants the person who has a license voluntarily. Okay, compulsory license, what is that? It's where the government issues a license for its own use or to a third party, a license to use the patented product without the consent of the patent holder. Now, that's a compulsory license. Now, what's the difference? Why not go for voluntary license? Why go for compulsory license? If you look at how voluntary license have come about, let me take the Malaysia case. After the government use authorization ended in 2005, the Ministry of Health tells us the patent holders are very cooperative. We saw, firstly, the prices of patented drugs dropped. They have also, I understand, given a voluntary license, which they would not have done if we had not issued a compulsory license first. So that's how that voluntary license came about. We are not privy to a lot of the details as to what are the contents of the voluntary license and how much royalty is to be paid. If you take the South African example as well, the voluntary license and reasonable terms that came about with the voluntary license only came after the Competition Commission came up with certain decisions against the patent holders. Only then we had a voluntary license with reasonable terms. Otherwise, the royalty that was being charged was, what, 30%, and it got reduced to, what, 5% now. So these are events that have actually forced patent holders to issue voluntary licenses. If you take the recent example of Tamiflu, when avian flu was hitting a lot of countries, Roche came up and said, firstly, we would not grant licenses, we would manufacture. And every day their position changed. And as more countries said that we would issue compulsory licenses, then they said, oh yeah, we will also issue voluntary licenses as well, to prevent the countries from setting a precedent by issuing compulsory licenses. So we see that patent holders are not voluntarily coming up and granting voluntary licenses. And if they do grant, it's on terms, for example, you can use it in the country, but you can't export it. The royalty is very high and things like that. So that was just the point I wanted to make. The other question is in relation to dispute settlement mechanism in free trade agreements. Very quickly, there are two types of dispute settlement in the free trade agreements that are being signed. First is the investor state dispute settlement, where the investor can take the state to court, to an investor tribunal that has been set up. Now, IP, intellectual property right, has been defined as investment. So if you take away, because investment is defined very broadly, so if you take away certain rights, that can amount to expropriation. And then the country would have to give compensation to the investor. Now, in some of the free trade agreements, compulsory license has been excluded. But it's just open to imagination on what grounds they can actually use this investor state dispute settlement and try to gain compensation from countries. The other mechanism that has been set up is country to country. And what we see is the use of non-violation complaints. In the WTO, there is currently a moratorium on the use of non-violation complaints when it comes to intellectual property rights. What is non-violation complaint? That means that even if a country has got a provision that is required by the FTA, but it nullifies and impairs the benefits that they can obtain by having that investment, then they can sue under non-violation complaint. So this is just very briefly before I just pass on to the next
final
speaker.
Comments.
Thank you.
I don't have any more questions, so I'm just going to have three concluding comments. I've got three messages, one for developing country governments, one for the pharma industry, the innovators, and one for the generic companies. To developing country governments, they really need to get their frameworks right and to do so in a way which enables the state to act, which enables civil society to act, and which enables the generic companies to take action themselves, although that may be wishful thinking in respect of the generic companies. For the pharma industry, they really need to license generic companies on reasonable terms, none of these terms that Sangeeta's been talking about. And if they don't do so on reasonable terms, we will determine whether those terms are reasonable or not. And if we're not satisfied with that, we will compel them to do so by going to court. And that's a message in South Africa for Abbott and for MSD. And then for the generic companies, really, it's also time to deliver. They have benefited from a lot of the work that we have done. Aspen Pharmacare in South Africa, its stocks have soared as a result of a lot of the work that we have done, and it's time that they bring much-needed products to market, that they bring new fixed-dose combinations, that they bring pediatric formulations, that they bring products like Ganciclovir and Amphotericin B. We need those products on the market. They can't sit back and relax and enjoy the fact that most of the attention is directed at the innovators and not at them. Thank you.
Well, I think we had a very rich way of seeing that actually in this globalized world, we had four different countries and continents were actually living the same type of problems, and that the implementation of the TRIPS agreement and now of free trade agreements are really not helping the access to medicine question. So I think we just ended a transition period, and if we compare it to the last AIDS conference where India was still not compliant with TRIPS, we are now in a situation where India is also TRIPS compliant, so we are actually at the beginning of a new era, and we see that the fight is only starting to try to improve the access to medicine in the world. And with the second line treatment crisis that is coming up, where most medicines are patented, I think that in 2 years, when we will meet again in another for the next AIDS conference, we certainly would have a long way of battles before us, with court trials and discussion about if TRIPS has or not to change, and if trade agreements have to go on a moratorium or not. And so I'm sure that we will have strong debate, but certainly I would like to thank also all the audience for the questions, and panelists will be here available probably for the ones who had not the chance to have an answer. Now I'll pass the word to our chair.
Thank you. I think you've summarized it well. We need a new world order if people are going to be put in front of profits. Thank you.